Bullets whizzed overhead. Still, we could see nothing. We waited, expecting to see our men out on flank security break cover and enter the safety of our perimeter. They never did. The sound came closer. Within seconds, the wood line changed. North Vietnamese troops shattered the foliage and headed straight for us, AK-47 rifles blazing on the dead run. I selected the closest one and fired twice. I hit him, but he refused to go down. He kept coming and shooting. I turned my M16 on full automatic, fired, and he crumpled. I shifted to another target and squeezed the trigger. Nothing happened. The fear I felt turned to terror. I saw a cartridge jammed in the chamber. I removed it, reloaded, and began firing again. They kept pouring out of the wood line. We kept firing. Then finally they stopped coming. On the ground in front of me lay the three magazines I taped together to carry my rifle, plus one other magazine. I had fired 80 rounds. The lull did not last long. Tolls peered beyond the anthill toward the mortar platoon. It appeared as if the ground was opening up and swallowing the mortar men they fell so fast. Shadden recalls. A brown wave of death rolled over them and on into Charlie Company. Vietnamese intermixed with them. Then reality set in. The enemy held the ground beyond the anthill. The column was cut in half. Incoming gunfire drew our attention back to the tree line. The firing rapidly increased. We returned fire at muzzle flashes. I heard an explosion behind me. Turning, I saw Chi-Com grenades landing. All flash and smoke, no casualties. The volume of fire became almost unendurable. Bullets peeled bark from trees. Vegetation disintegrated. I looked to Lieutenant James Lawrence for help. Saw his head violently recoil. He hit the ground. A second later, I was spun around, then slammed into the dirt. I rose to my hands and knees and started down the line. Blood ran everywhere. The mortar platoon sergeant's .45 pistol had been shot from his hand. His right hand hung limp from his wrist and blood poured to the ground. Someone tried to dress his wound. Someone raised Lieutenant Lawrence and attempted to steady him. The firing continued. Tolls's tight 12-man line was shrinking fast. I turned back toward the wood line and detected movement. I shifted in that direction and spotted North Vietnamese in the underbrush. Enemy turning our flank. Our position was no longer tenable. I turned back with the warning. Sergeant Jerry Baker took charge now. He realized we needed to pull out. He appointed the unwounded and some slightly wounded to help the severely wounded. An instant later, he ordered the move. I led this retreat because of my position on the battle line. I rose to my feet and headed in the only direction void of enemy fire, toward our left rear at a run. 30 or 40 yards and I broke out of the trees into a large clearing of waist-deep grass. The sunlight hurt my eyes. 20 yards into the field, I noticed the man running a half-step to my rear go down. I dove to the ground and turned to see PFC Marlon Clarenbake struggling with a leg wound. Captain George Forrest was now back with his Alpha Company 1st Battalion 5th Cavalry soldiers at the rear of the column. I had lost my radio operators, and when I got back and got another radio, I found out McDade's lead elements were in heavy firefights to their front and to their west. I got maybe 2 transmissions from McDade, then lost contact. We circled up. My parent battalion had come up on my net, and I was able to contact Captain Buse Tully, commander of Bravo Company, 1st Battalion, 5th Cav. I have never felt such relief at hearing and recognizing a voice. I knew someone who cared about us was close at hand. Here's what the Vietnam War looked like in mid-afternoon of November 17th, through the eyes of 2 of Captain Forrest's Alpha Company riflemen, PFC David A. Perp Lavender of Murfreesboro, Illinois, and Specialist Ford James Young of Steelville, Missouri, says Lavender. My platoon was bringing up the rear. We started to maneuver and work our way up the column to help those up ahead. Every time we made a move, we were hit by mortars. It was something you can't describe. People were dropping like flies. The first blast killed a young soldier named PFC Vincent Locatelli. Every time we moved, they dropped mortars on us. I knew we must have had 12 or 15 wounded out of our platoon, including our platoon leader. These were my buddies I'd been in the Army with for 2 years. The majority of our whole battalion had been drafted at age 21 and had been in service for over 18 months. All of us were near 23 years old. They became my brothers over time. Hearing these fellows scream, hearing them killed, stuck in my heart and mind ever since. The most critical part of this fight was the beginning. It was the surprise. They had us in a U-shaped ambush, and they had us cut off with mortars. Rifleman Jim Young says, I sat down and took a nap. We had flankers at 100 yards or so on left and right, so I thought it was safe to grab some sleep. That little bit of shooting up front got a lot worse. That woke me up. Then our first platoon received mortar fire. 5 men wounded. I heard them calling for medics. Mortars kept coming in. Heard them order 1st Platoon to pull back out of the area where those rounds were hitting. Young's platoon was ordered to get online and move in reaction to the enemy fire. Everyone hit the ground when those mortars began coming in. They told us to move ahead toward the enemy. We got online and we walked right into an enemy ambush. They were behind trees, anthills, and down on the ground. There was waist-high grass and a lot of trees around us. There were enemy soldiers in that grass. They were hard to see, and we had to shoot where we thought they were. The medic had his hands full, couldn't take care of all the wounded. One man to my right was hit in the heel. His name was Harold Smith. There was a grassy field to my left, 25 or 30 yards, and a sniper off on my right. I couldn't see him, but I saw a tracer bullet go across my hand. I felt the wind of that bullet. The same bullet passed over the back of Smith's neck. He was lucky he had his head down. Our company commander, Captain Forrest, came running along our line. He was stopping and telling everybody where to go. He acted as though he was immune to the enemy fire. I don't know how he kept from getting hit. Just ahead of Alpha Company, 1st Battalion and the hodgepodge of admin and supply staffers, medics and communications people that constituted headquarters company of the 2nd Battalion 7th Cavalry, marched Doc William Schuchart, the 2nd Battalion surgeon, Lieutenant John Howard of the medical platoon, and Lieutenant Bud Alley, the communications platoon leader, says Schuchart. Before the fight, I remember smelling cigarette smoke. Vietnamese cigarettes. I said, I smell the enemy smoking. The next thing we knew, mortars were dropping all around us, then a lot of small arms fire was coming in, and then everything just dissolved into confusion. We thought that the head of the column had gotten turned, and somehow we were getting shot by our own troops. Guys were dropping all around us. It seemed like in a very short time I found myself all alone. We had gotten widely dispersed. I was running around with my M16. I had a 45 pistol, which was useless, and I picked up somebody's M16. I was under direct enemy fire all this time. I got one little zinger up my back, nothing serious, just a grazing wound that left me a nice little scar. This was the most scared I've ever been in my life. I was wearing a St. Christopher's medal around my neck that somebody had sent me. I thought, this is the time to make a deal. Then I thought, I've never been very religious. He isn't likely to want a deal. So I got up, and started looking for somebody, anybody. I found one of our radio operators dead and got on his radio trying to raise somebody. I remember trying to get them to throw some smoke so I could find them. Lieutenant John Howard remembers, "Soon after the first shots, mortars and grenades started hitting all around us. The small arms fire then picked up to an intense level and soldiers started going down very quickly with gunshot or shrapnel wounds. There was confusion and some thought they were being fired at by other American soldiers in the area. This confusion cleared up pretty quickly as the North Vietnamese assault wave moved in so close that we could see them and hear them talking. They suddenly appeared behind anthills and up in the trees, sniping at anyone who moved, and we found ourselves shooting at them in all directions. As we crawled around in the tall elephant grass, it was very difficult to tell where anyone was or whether they were friendly or enemy. One thing I caught on to very quickly was how the NVA were signaling to each other in the high grass by tapping on the wooden stocks of their AK-47 rifles. Lieutenant Bud Alley recalls clearly when word came back that recon had been shot at. Then that recon had hit an ambush. Then orders to Charlie Company just in front of us to move on line and roll up the flank of it. John Howard and I were sitting beside each other. All of a sudden, a couple of shots rang out 25 yards in front of us. By now, we're all standing up scared. The call comes back, "Medic, medic." The first group of medics in front of us takes off and John Howard takes off with them. Now the leaves begin to shake as bullets are coming in. The infantry and Charlie Company are yelling, "Get on line." I pushed my guys up on line 25 yards inside the tree line and suddenly all hell broke loose. There was lots of shooting and it was difficult to maintain the line. A fellow got hit and screamed. My radio operator and I ran up to him and dragged him behind a little tree. He was shot through the wrist and kept screaming. Then he got shot again. I put my M16 on automatic and fired up high and something fell out of the tree. I crawled down to an anthill where a couple of guys were. I stayed there and found a guy who had a radio. I called him to see what the hell was happening. About then the net went dead. Somebody got shot with his finger on the transmit key or something. The last thing I heard on the net was that Ghost 5 got hit. That was Don Cornett, the Charlie Company executive officer. Colonel Tim Brown, the 3rd Brigade commander, the man who had the authority to order in reinforcements, was overheard in his command helicopter asking his ground commander, Lieutenant Colonel Bob McDade, for information on the seriousness of the situation. With Brown was the brigade fire support coordinator, Captain Dudley Tatamy, who was eager to unleash all the artillery, air support, and aerial rocket artillery at his command. Brown and Tatamy had just left LZ Columbus, where they had been talking to Lieutenant Colonel Tully, when the first shots were fired at Albany. Colonel Brown was headed back to brigade headquarters at the tea plantation. Captain Tatamy recalls, "Suddenly I heard Joe Price, the artillery forward observer with McDade's battalion, saying, 'We have a problem. I need help.' Price was hollering for everything he could get, air, artillery, ARA. We finally got him to slow down so we could understand what was happening. I notified Colonel Brown that something was going on down there. He tried to get on the command net and talk to McDade. I stayed on the artillery net trying to get some support for them. By then, we were overflying their position, and we could see puffs of smoke coming out of the woods. When Joe Price would come up on the net, I could hear the loud firing over their radio." Major Roger Bartholomew, commander of the aerial rocket artillery helicopters, was in contact with Captain Tatamy and flew a zigzag pattern over the forest, trying to get a fix on the location of friendly troops so that his helicopters could support them. He had no luck. Captain Tatamy had the artillery fire smoke rounds to try to register defensive fires. No luck there either. It didn't help because everybody was so mixed up by then on the ground. We had tactical air, ARA, and artillery, and still we couldn't do a damn thing. It was the most helpless, hopeless thing I ever witnessed. Colonel Tim Brown's helicopter was running low on fuel, and the chopper had to return to Kateka to refuel. Brown says, I knew they were in contact. I did not know how severe or anything else. While I was talking to McDade, I could hear the rifle fire, but he didn't know what was happening. I asked, what happened to your lead unit? He didn't know. Where's your trailing units? He didn't know. And he didn't know what had happened to any of the rest of them. Nobody knew what the hell was going on. We were not in a position to shoot a bunch of artillery or airstrikes in there because we didn't know where to put them. Captain John Cash, in the center of the now busy brigade headquarters at Kateka, recalls the return of Colonel Brown. Brown was standing there on our radio asking McDade what's going on, yelling, God damn it, what is going on out there? McDade came back with, got a couple of KIAs killed in action here and trying to get a handle on the situation. Let me get back to you later. Out. Captain Tatamy, who was at Brown's side in the Tactical Operations Center, TOC, says, I heard McDade talking. Brown kept asking him what was going on. The radio speakers were all blaring. What I was hearing was that things were not going well in McDade's area. After his command helicopter had refueled, Brown flew back into the valley. All of a sudden, I heard all kinds of firing while I was talking to McDade on the radio. He started yelling, they're running, they're running. I thought for one terrible moment he meant that his battalion was running. What it was, the Air Force had dropped napalm on a company-sized North Vietnamese unit, and they were running, not the Americans. About then I began to figure that McDade was in real trouble. Only now did Colonel Brown begin rounding up reinforcements to send in to help Bob McDade's 2nd Battalion. Brown ordered Lieutenant Colonel Frederick Ackerson to send a company from his 1st Battalion 5th Cavalry overland from Elsie Columbus toward Elsie Albany. Ackerson dispatched Captain Walker B. Buse Tully's Bravo Company, 1st Battalion, 5th Cavalry, on the 2-mile march toward the tail of McDade's embattled column. Meanwhile, Brown radioed orders warning McDade's missing component, Captain Myron Diderick's Bravo Company, 2nd Battalion, 7th Cav, to prepare to be airlifted from Camp Holloway into landing zone Albany. Brown acknowledges that it was too little too late. I've thought a good deal about this action over the years, and I believe that most of the casualties occurred in the first hour of fighting. I think the bulk of it was done right at the very first. They did not have decent security for moving through the jungle. Lieutenant Colonel McDade, for his part, confirms that he was unable to provide Colonel Brown with detailed reports of what was happening to 3 of the 4 companies in his stalled column, most of which were out of sight and out of reach. Says McDade, in that first hour or so, the situation was so fluid that I was acting more as a platoon leader than a battalion commander. We were trying to secure a perimeter. I was trying to figure out what the hell was going on myself. I don't think anybody in the battalion could have told you what the situation really was at that time. I can see where I might have left Tim Brown in the dark about what was going on. I didn't really know myself until things quieted down. The battalion commander adds, I could have yelled and screamed that we were in a death trap and all that crap, but I didn't know it was as bad as it was. I had no way of checking visually or physically by getting out of that perimeter, so all I could do was hope to get back in touch. I wasn't going to scream that the sky was falling, especially in a situation where nobody could do anything about it anyway. Lieutenant Colonel John A. Hemphill was the operations officer at Brigadier General Knowles' Division Forward Command Post at Pleiku. He recalls that he and Knowles flew over the Ia Drang on November 17th and watched the B-52 bombing strike on the Chu Pong Massif. Then they flew back to Pleiku. Says Hemphill, when we got back to Pleiku, here came Tim Brown to see Knowles. I brought him to Knowles, and he said, I have not heard from or made contact with McDade, and I am concerned. So we went piling out and flew out in late afternoon, and that's when I think was the first time we were aware that anything was amiss. Although Knowles does not recall the Brown visit to his headquarters described by Hemphill, he does have a vivid memory of how he first learned that McDade's battalion was heavily engaged with the enemy. I had a warrant officer in the support command at Pleiku. His job was to watch the beams, bullets, fuel, and casualties. He had a direct hotline to me. I wanted to know immediately when things got off track. In the afternoon around 2 or 3 o'clock, he called me and said, "I got 14 KIA from McDade's battalion." All the bells went off. I called my pilot, Wayne Knudsen, and John Stoner, my air liaison officer, and went out to see McDade. I stopped that 3rd Brigade before flying on out to Albany. Tim Brown had nothing to tell me. Knowles adds, "We got over Albany and McDade was in deep trouble. I wanted to land. McDade said, 'General, I can't handle you. I can't even get medevac in.' I couldn't land. I wanted to get something moving on the ground over there. I told Stoner and Bill Becker, the division artillery commander, 'This guy doesn't know what he's got. Put a ring of steel around him.' I could help him with firepower and did. I then went back to see Tim, who still had no information. I was irked. A hell of a mess, no question." The 2nd Battalion, 7th Cavalry, had been reduced from a full battalion in column line of march to a small perimeter defended by a few Alpha Company survivors, the recon platoon, a handful of stragglers from Charlie and Delta Companies, and the battalion command group at the Albany Landing Zone clearing, plus one other small perimeter, 500 to 700 yards south, which consisted of Captain George Forrest's Alpha Company 1st Battalion, 7th Cavalry. In between, dead or wounded or hiding in the tall grass, was the bulk of Bob McDade's command. The fragments of 2 rifle companies, a weapons company, and headquarters company. Each and every man still alive on that field, American and North Vietnamese, was fighting for his life. In the tall grass, it was nearly impossible for the soldiers of either side to identify friend or foe except at extremely close range. Americans in olive drab and North Vietnamese in mustard brown were fighting and dying side by side. It may have begun as a meeting engagement, a hasty ambush, a surprise attack, a battle of maneuver, and in fact it was all of those things. But within minutes, the result was a wild melee, a shootout, with the gunfighters killing not only the enemy, but sometimes their friends, just a few feet away. There would be no cheap victory here this day for either side. There would be no victory at all. Just the terrible certainty of death in the tall grass. Chapter 20. Death in the Tall Grass. I did not mean to be killed today. Dying words of the Vicomte de Turenne at the Battle of Salzbach, 1675. The North Vietnamese commander on the battlefield, Nguyen Hu An, has a keen memory of that bloody afternoon of November 17, 1965, on the trail to Landing Zone Albany. "My commanders and soldiers reported there was very vicious fighting. I tell you frankly, your soldiers fought valiantly. They had no choice. You are dead or not. It was hand-to-hand fighting. Afterward, when we policed the battlefield, when we picked up our wounded, the bodies of your men and our men were neck to neck, lying alongside each other. It was most fierce." That it was. And nowhere more fierce than along that strung-out American column where the cavalry rifle companies had been cut into small groups. Lieutenant John Howard was with headquarters company near the tail of the column. At some point early in the battle, I was situated next to a large anthill. A sergeant not far from me had received a nasty wound to his foot and he was screaming in pain. I crawled over next to him and started to bandage his foot. No sooner had I told him to try to quit screaming than I was hit by a bullet which spun me completely around on the ground. It had hit me on the right side of my stomach. I pulled up my shirt to see how bad it was, and luckily, it had cut through my flesh, but had not gone into my stomach. I had a flesh wound about 5 inches long. Bullets continued to hit all around Howard. He grabbed the sergeant and told him they needed to move around to the other side of the anthill. On the other side, we joined up with 4 other soldiers who were grouped together in the grass. We continued to fire at North Vietnamese soldiers behind trees and anthills and tried to figure out what we should do next. Although they were now out of sight of each other, Lieutenant Bud Alley, the 2nd Battalion Communications Officer and Howard's friend, was not far away. "It was consternation," said Alley. "Men on either side of me were being shot. At that point, I had not seen any of the enemy. All I could see was the trees and our guys. I tried to move up to my right. I moved into a hail of bullets. Everyone was trying to keep moving up toward the landing zone. I was at a big anthill pinned down by a machine gun. Fellow on my right, a Puerto Rican, was wounded. I traded the Puerto Rican PFC my .45 pistol for his machine gun. I took the machine gun and moved around left of the anthill and tried to move forward, firing to my front. I crawled up on a man behind a little tree. Then 2 enemy automatic weapons opened up, cutting that little tree down. He screamed and hit me in the back. I rolled over on top of him, and he had both hands over his face. He told me, "Don't worry about me, I'm dead." He opened his hands, and he had a bullet hole right in the center of his forehead. He pulled 2 grenades and threw those grenades. I started crawling back to the big anthill where I'd come from. I knew we weren't going forward. By the time I got back to the anthill, the wounded guy, a dead guy or two, another wounded guy, and my radio repairmen were there all huddled behind that anthill. "Which way do we go?" William Schuchart, the battalion surgeon, was also in that section of the column. I got up and started looking for somebody, anybody. I ran on and encountered a couple of enemy soldiers. This meeting scared the shit out of me and them both. I got the M16 up and fired before they did. That was the end of that. Then I looked over and saw this sergeant leaning against a tree. He said, "Can I give you a hand, Captain?" Calm as could be. That was Sergeant Fred Klug of Alpha Company, 1st Battalion, 5th Cav. We went back to a larger group at the rear of the column, maybe 15 or 20 guys, with several wounded. We were in an area with a lot of wounded and no supplies, only a few styrets of morphine and some bandages. Just forward of the headquarters section of the column, Charlie Company was beginning to die. Specialist 4 Jack Smith was with the lead elements in the Charlie Company formation, near Lieutenant Don Cornett, the acting company commander, when the company charged into the teeth of the enemy machine guns. In the first second, Smith saw one of the radio operators fall dead, with a bullet through the chest, his eyes and tongue bulging out. The men of Charlie Company were firing in all directions. Suddenly, Smith says he heard a low moan from Lieutenant Don Cornett. He tore off the officer's green fatigue shirt and saw a bullet wound in his back to the right of his spine. He and another soldier began bandaging the lieutenant's wound. Smith thought how dependent they all were on this one man, now badly hurt, who was the only leader in reach. Then a man beside Smith was shot in the arm and a torn artery began spurting blood. Then a round tore through one of Cornett's boots, tearing away all the toes on his foot. Now a North Vietnamese with a Maxim heavy machine gun appeared just 3 feet in front of Smith. The young soldier flicked the selector switch on his M16 to full automatic and fired a long burst into the face of the enemy machine gunner. An exploding grenade took down another American close by. Only a few minutes had passed, but Jack Smith's world was being shot to death all around him. Then, he says, something happened that convinced him to keep fighting. Lieutenant Don Cornett, in agony from his wounds, told Smith he was going to do something to try to get his troops organized. Cornet crawled away into the high grass. A brave young lieutenant died doing his duty somewhere out there in hand-to-hand fighting. Smith recalls, "Within a span of perhaps 20 minutes, everyone around me was dead or wounded. Except me." You have to understand that in our area, the elephant grass was chest high. Once you hit the dirt, your world was about as big as a dining room table. Your world was completely confined to that area and the 6 or 7 men around you. At that point, we were isolated. Alpha Company was in the same shape. Then the North Vietnamese swept through. I believe they came between Alpha and our company and began to shoot people. We didn't know if the noise from 5 feet away as they began to shoot people was friendly or enemy. Smith saw soldiers take machine guns, lie flat on the ground, and begin firing into the grass. Often they were firing right into the muzzles of other American machine guns. People were screaming to stop the shooting. It began to have all the elements of a massacre. Nobody was in control because all the officers were to the front and our radio operators had fallen dead on their radio sets. Just forward of Charlie Company with the Delta Company mortars, PFC James Shadden was in agony from his 2 severe wounds. By this time, some of the NVA were coming through the area, killing all who were screaming and calling for medics. Snyder Bembry was killed in this manner by an English-speaking North Vietnamese, probably an officer. He shot Bembry as Bembry screamed with a full automatic weapon and then spoke these words in English. "Wait a minute, who are we shooting?" I almost blurted out "Americans" in answer before I realized what was happening. He had an accent. PFC Snyder P. Bembry of Unadilla, Georgia, was 21 years old when he died. Unable to fight back or do anything to save his buddies from the Vietnamese executioners, James Shadden took the last course left to him. He booby-trapped his own body. "The shot in the arm left me with nothing but a grenade, which I couldn't throw left-handed, so I refrained from trying," Shadden recalls. "And more of the enemy were coming my way from the other side. So I slid the grenade under my armpit, pin-pulled. I figured, if they got me, I might get them." Specialist 4 Bob Tolles of the Delta Company anti-tank platoon had run into a grassy clearing, leading the way for a dozen of his buddies, several of them badly wounded. He stopped and looked back through the woods toward the column. "I peered through the grass and managed to locate our previous position. There were the North Vietnamese, rummaging what we had left behind. Then they fired bursts from their AKs into the ground. Now I realized what else we had left behind. All of us hadn't made it out of there. I considered shooting at them. But I thought better about it. It would only attract their attention, and we were in no condition to fight." Most of the people with Tolles were wounded, sprawling on the ground and lying on top of each other. "We couldn't function as a combat unit from this pile. At that moment, Sergeant Baker ordered me to move out again. I got up and headed for the woodline on the far side of the clearing. After covering about 50 yards, I noticed movement in the trees off to my right. Americans. I cut to the right and entered the clump of trees. 10 or 15 yards into the trees, 2 shots rang out. I heard them whiz by behind me. Sergeant Baker lurched and fell. 1 bullet struck his chest, the other his back. He was a half step behind and to the left of me. I stopped, knelt, and scanned the trees. Nothing. Sergeant Baker clutched his chest and ordered me to keep going. Just then, someone else reached him and helped him to get up. Tolles rose and turned in the direction he had been heading before Baker went down. I saw Sergeant Miguel Baeza kneeling behind a tree and got to him. It took a few moments to catch my breath and compose myself. Then I asked him for information about this sector. He wasn't sure. I informed him the enemy had wiped out the mortar platoon, then overran Charlie Company. Baeza pulled out his bayonet, slit my shirt sleeve, and bandaged my right arm. My hand had frozen to the pistol grip of my M16, but my trigger finger still worked. No pain. My arm was numb. I looked around our position. It seemed pretty good. Trees large enough to give some protection formed an arc facing a clearing opposite the one we had just traversed. The other men formed up facing the direction we had just come from. A few men guarded off west and north. I noticed PFC Lester Becker off by himself facing east. His large tree could easily be occupied by two men. I told Sergeant Baeza I'd go over with Becker and help cover that area. I ran the 10 yards to the tree and took position on the right side of it. From behind that tree, Bob Tolles and Lester Becker heard moaning nearby in the tall grass of the clearing and decided to investigate. Tolles remembers, I went around the right side of the tree, Becker the left. Instantly two shots. I heard the chilling sound of the bullets thump as they both hit soft tissue. I stared, paralyzed with disbelief as Becker slumped to the ground, grasping his stomach. I couldn't move. Others ran across and dragged him to the shelter of the tree. At that moment, Captain Hank Thorpe, the Delta Company commander, appeared behind us. He shouted for us to fall back to his position. We obeyed and carried Becker on a poncho. Once there, we left Becker with the medics. He survived to be medevaced, but died later. Becker, 25, was from Harvard, Illinois. Tolles' small group of Delta Company survivors had reached the Albany clearing. They joined the thin line of defenders in the cluster of trees where the battalion command post was located. At the other end of the column, Captain George Forrest was now heading his men of Alpha Company, 1st Battalion, 5th Cavalry, off the trail and into a defensive posture. Alpha Company rifleman James Young remembers Forrest ordering their withdrawal across a grassy clearing that was under enemy fire and then asking for a volunteer for a dangerous mission. Alpha Company was taking incoming fire from a machine gun that, by the sound of it, was an American M60. Forrest wanted someone to crawl out into the tall grass, locate the machine gun, and tell the gunners that they were shooting fellow Americans. Young, who had grown up in the Missouri backwoods and knew something about stalking, said he would go.
Another rifleman, a PFC from Chicago, Ronald Fortune, said he would go with me. We started crawling with that machine gun firing over our heads. It was an M60, and we all assumed it was Americans. When we got close, 50 or 60 yards away, we started yelling at them. Then I realized that they were enemy. It was as though someone told me, these are not our men. They are not responding to our calls.
Young told Fortune to stop yelling.
I continued to crawl in their direction, trying to locate their exact position. I intended to take them out. Then a bullet struck me in the head. I knew I was hit in the head, and I thought I was going to die. It dazed me good, but didn't knock me out. I had my chin strap on, so it didn't knock my helmet off. I asked Fortune if he would get in touch with my parents and tell them that my last concern was for them. I thought it was over for me. I asked him to bandage me. He took the bandage off my belt and he patched me up. He was telling me it wasn't too bad, that I was going to be all right. Then I tried to crawl in the direction of the machine gun again. Fortune thought I was out of my head and tried to stop me. We were both down low. Every time I would move, he would grab me by my legs and hold me. After struggling with me for a while, he said, I'm going back, and he left. I told him I was going to get that machine gun. What it was, I really was afraid to turn my back on that machine gun.
The machine gun bullet had pierced Young's helmet and crushed his skull on one side of his head. But he was still determined to take out that gun.
As I moved, I heard the Vietnamese calling out something. After that, I never heard the gunfire again. What I heard were orders for them to pack it up and move. I moved to where I thought it was, still afraid to raise my head on account of snipers. There was lots of shooting. I never found the gun. They were gone.
Lieutenant Enrique Pujals, a Pennsylvania Military College classmate of Lieutenant Jack O'Hagan of Charlie Company, 1st Battalion, 7th Cav, who was killed at LZ X-Ray,
was leading the 24-man 3rd Platoon of Captain Skip Fessmeyer's Charlie Company, 2nd Battalion. His platoon, bringing up the rear of the company, was just ahead of the headquarters detachment. Pujals says he had his men in column formation, but not in single file, when the shooting erupted. Then I got the order on my radio. Deploy your platoon and maneuver right. I used hand and arm signals to get the platoon online. When I looked back, I was several yards ahead on my own, and the platoon was still in their positions. I went back, giving verbal commands to get online and follow me, and to pass the word. Some were getting together when the radio operator called me and said the company commander had a message for me. Hold where you are. Stop the maneuver and fire only at a target. I tried to get information on what the hell was going on, but he said out. The firing was still going on up to my right front. Then bullets started to come our way. I thought they were from the lead American elements. Not many, but they caused me concern. I tried to raise anyone on the radio to get them to watch where they fired and to give me a situation report. Still nothing. I tried to form a perimeter of sorts. Meanwhile, up front, the screams kept on as part of the weird symphony of battle sounds. Pujals couldn't believe that the entire battalion was firing everything it had just because of a couple of snipers. I told my radio operator that I was moving up to find the weapons platoon leader. The vegetation changed as I moved. Where my platoon was, there were trees and shrubs 10 to 15 feet apart in waist-high grass. For me, 5'6" tall, sometimes it was nearly neck-high. But the weapons platoon had entered a very thick spot with thick grass and very, very tall clumps of bushes. We were moving in column. The weapons platoon was in file. Pujals asked a couple of the men he met where their platoon leader was and was told, up ahead. Very few men were prone. Very few were facing out toward the firing. Most were leaning on something or other, resting. Nobody seemed to know what was going on. I moved ahead. I was on the outskirts of the thicket when I felt a stabbing shock on my left heel. I thought I had stepped on one of those infamous punji stakes. I grabbed my left leg to pull it off when I felt like I'd been struck with a sledgehammer on my right thigh. I saw it out of the corner of my eye. A little puff of dust in the trouser leg split, and I knew I was hit. My thoughts were silly, a little phrase we had used back in the world to signify something was amiss. There goes the weekend. My right leg just twisted all out of shape and began to crumple under me. I tried to shove myself as far back as I could to avoid having it fold under me as I fell. I made it. My leg was stretched in front of me in a more or less normal position. My thigh was broken. No doubt about it. I was now flat on my back and useless and helpless. What could I do? Yes, call for the medic. But what if they killed my medic as he came to help me? I was bleeding, and if I kept this up, I'd bleed to death, so I chanced it and called. He came over with one of my fire team leaders. They patched me up. I had them splint my M16 to my right leg up high. Then the medic took out a morphine ampule. I refused, protested, tried to avoid it, but I still got stuck. They pulled me up to a tree and helped me take off my pack. I had 15 loaded magazines in it and 800 rounds extra I'd picked up at Chu Pong. The guys from the 1st Battalion 7th Cav had said to take as much ammo as you could carry and then more. I asked for my 2 canteens and they got them for me. Pujals called to his platoon sergeant and told him to take command. And as he did, the firing shifted. My platoon began to get it. The blades of grass were cut at the level of my chest and fell on me. Now the screams were from my men. I did not see them die, but I certainly heard them. One of them screamed, "Oh my God, forgive me." I still believed we were under fire by our own troops. I was extremely angry. My men were dying around me and I could do nothing. Those were my thoughts. Later I learned the truth and was ashamed. At the head of the column, the small group of men and officers with Lieutenant Colonel McDade was locked in a heavy firefight with an enemy determined to overrun them. Captain Joel Sugdinis of Alpha Company, 2nd Battalion, still worried about his missing 2nd Platoon, had shifted to the southeastern side of the grove of trees to watch the area across the clearing where his men had disappeared. Sugdinis recalls, "I could see movement, but I couldn't tell whether they were our people or the enemy. I saw one soldier stand up and start helping a wounded soldier hobble away from the battle. I picked up binoculars. When I focused in on the two, they were North Vietnamese, and the more healthy one was firing his AK-47 from his hip at what appeared to be objects close to his feet. My thought was that he was executing our wounded. I fired one shot and they both went down. After the battle, we removed many of our 2nd Platoon dead from that area, and several had been shot in the head." Someone from the vicinity of the command group yelled that the North Vietnamese were crawling up on us from the south. There was an open area on the south side with knee to waist-high grass. Those of us who were standing turned and began firing into the grass. Several North Vietnamese attempted to flee. One North Vietnamese stood up and continued to advance directly toward us, firing his AK-47 from his hip, John Wayne style. I think everyone who saw him fired directly into him. I'm sure it was only a second or two, but it seemed he would never go down. Lieutenant Pat Payne and his recon platoon had been in the thick of the fight around the Albany clearing since the beginning. During the first hour, at least, we did not have any artillery coverage at all. We were learning a bitter lesson. The second thing is, we had no helicopter coverage. We had no gunships overhead. For that first hour or two, it was belly-to-belly and man-to-man. It didn't make any difference if you were a major, captain, sergeant, or private. We were all standing shoulder-to-shoulder, shooting it out with the NVA. I can hear the cry, "Here they come." And we would all rise up and cut loose. There was fear in the air, but I never sensed panic. At least, not after the first 10 or 20 minutes. Payne thought the North Vietnamese had done a much better job of anticipating and preparing for the attack. But the Americans who survived the initial onslaught began to rally. In one respect, you could think of it as the Little Bighorn. We were surrounded, with our packs in front of us shooting it out. During the course of that long afternoon, I never saw a soldier not do his duty. I never saw anyone who cowered in the face of the enemy. Our backs were against the wall, and it was a matter of survival. Every person I saw rose to the occasion. Somewhere during the afternoon, we started to get some sort of artillery support. However, since we were so spread out, I don't recall us being able to use it effectively for close fire support. The fighting had been underway for well over an hour when Lieutenant Larry Gwynn, the Alpha Company executive officer, looked to the northwest where Alpha Company's 1st Platoon had disappeared in the first assault. He was stunned by what he saw. Two men were staggering over to our position. They were Staff Sergeant Walter T. Capel, Acting Platoon Sergeant, and Staff Sergeant Rother A. Temple, a squad leader. They had fought their way out of the trap. They were exhausted and they indicated they were probably the only ones left alive. They did say that some of the company mortar platoon were in position with the Delta Company people and were okay. But we had still lost our command. Now came the event that would turn the course of the battle at the head of the column in the Americans' favor. Lieutenant Gwynn describes what happened. Captain Jim Spires, the battalion S3, comes dodging into our position. He tells us that tactical air is on the way and wants to know where our people are. What's our situation? He asks if any men are still out there. We said nothing. Spires said, "You mean everybody out there is either dead or captured?" The silence was eloquent. Spires said, "You sure?" He was satisfied we were. He ran back to the battalion anthill. The air was on the way, but I don't remember any artillery or ARA. Nobody knew where anybody was. Shortly afterward, the command came over the battalion net. Throw smoke. Lieutenant Gwynn moved a little way into the grass, and the men on the Albany perimeter all began to throw smoke grenades. I saw Skip Fessmeyer, Charlie Company commander, throwing smoke. I had no idea what the hell he was doing up here. Our perimeter was marked with all colors of smoke, delineating our positions, and shortly after, the airstrike started. They were A-1E Sky Raiders with napalm. The first napalm canister fell right at the point where Sugdinis and I had left the jungle and came into the clearing. We could see masses of North Vietnamese on the other side. I was very sure they were going to come across at us. I think they were cleaning up over there, shooting down at the ground, dispatching our wounded. That first strike was right on target with two napalm cans. I saw them hit the tops of the trees, and jellied napalm was coming down through the tree limbs, and the NVA were jumping up, trying to get away, and being engulfed in the flames. I saw that time and time again. The slow, reliable old Sky Raiders worked their way around the tree line surrounding the hard-pressed defenders of the Albany clearing, first using their canisters of napalm jellied gasoline, then their 250-pound bombs, and then employing their 20-millimeter cannons to strafe the swarming North Vietnamese. Lieutenant Gwynn remembers, "It cleaned out swath after swath. Those fuckers would jump up and try to run. They didn't make it." By now, the Americans were cheering and laughing at each strike. The cheering stopped when they dropped two canisters directly onto the position where the remnants of the second platoon had been making their stand. It might have been me. But all I could hear was the crackling of the unexpected rounds burning in the flames that had engulfed our men. None of us know if there were any still alive at the time. But then, none of us want to think about it. Gwynn and others noticed that the enemy firing had slackened, but that as each of the Sky Raiders made its bombing run, the jungle all around erupted with enemy fire as the North Vietnamese aimed everything they had at the swooping aircraft. Gwynn says, "I marveled at how beautiful those birds looked, flying directly at our position and letting fly with all they had." Then Gwynn rolled over, looked up, and saw an A-1E heading his way. It let go the canister and it was coming right at me. It passed so close overhead, I could see the rivets, and it struck in the middle of that field. One North Vietnamese jumped up and ran toward us, and we shot him dead. I guess they dropped 15 or 20 cans of napalm. One aircraft dropped his napalm in the field to our front. I thought he made a mistake bringing it in so close, but as it crashed to the ground and the flames burst, about five enemy leaped up only 30 yards from our perimeter and were cut in half by our fire. The last incident involved one particular enemy-manned anthill to our front with a heavy machine gun behind it, firing at the A-1Es. The crew never faltered in the face of imminent death and continued firing until one of the last napalm cans dropped smack dab on that gun and cremated the entire anthill. Lieutenant Pat Payne, the recon platoon leader, remembers the blessed relief that the Air Force delivered. They were a sight for sore eyes, and the cheers rang out as they made their first runs. The plane was so close that as the pilot flew by, you could see his profile in the cockpit. He made repeated passes to strafe the advancing NVA. He would slow the plane, slow it down, shoot his guns, and literally chew the ground up in front of him. Other planes arrived and began to use napalm. You could see a large number of North Vietnamese, 50 or 100, quite a number, within 50 or 75 yards of us, massing to attack when one of the Air Force planes dropped the napalm on a direct hit on them. We began to cheer. Major Frank Henry and Captain Joe Price, the battalion's fire support coordinator, not only got the Air Force on target, but also, for the first time in the fight, began calling down artillery strikes around the Albany clearing on clearly visible clusters of North Vietnamese soldiers in the tree line. In those areas, at least, they were fairly confident no Americans were alive. the future of what was left of this battalion began to look a little bit better. Although badly wounded, Sergeant Major Jim Scott remembers the moment. After the air support arrived, the artillery started coming in. This was about 2 hours into the fight. They would see groups of the enemy and call down fire on them. All of this was within 50 yards of us. I could actually see from my position on top of an anthill the NVA attempting to charge the battalion. They would form up 40 or 50 men. Then, Frank Henry or the artillery officer would adjust the fire on them. All of a sudden, there was a lull in the battle, around 4 or 5 p.m. It got quiet. I knew the battalion would survive. Up till then, I didn't believe we could. We had radio reports coming in that the other companies in the column were cut off in bad shape, taking multiple casualties. They were fighting in isolated platoons and squads. I knew the casualties had to be heavy, but I don't think anyone knew exactly what the situation was at that time. Everyone was scattered.
Lieutenant Colonel McDade was understandably concerned when contact was made with the A1Es about where they would put down the napalm and how close. We had to worry about the risk of hitting our other people. I had no idea what George Forrest's A15 company was. I knew they were close and had some general idea which direction, but we had to use the napalm, and the question was, could we use it safely? We decided, let's bring it in as close as we can to ourselves. That would mean we were backing it away from the other units. It worked. Back in the column, Lieutenant Bud Alley continued to search for a secure perimeter but couldn't find one. Lieutenant Butch All, Charlie Company platoon leader, and one of his guys came down a little slope. He was looking for his people. He slid right in front of me on his knees. I pulled him down. About then, they opened up on us. He said, look where they shot me. He was wearing a .45 tanker rig holster. He had a slug in the holster and his .45 pistol, which was right over his chest. He said he was okay, but they almost got me. I asked him what we ought to do to get out of this mess. He said we needed to move over to the left side of the column, that they had it under better control there. There were six or seven in the group. Butch All told them they should count out loud and on the signal jump up and run. About then, the A1Es made a strafing run right over them. All said, we better go now. Then, says Allie, Butch took off first in front of me. We were just going to go five paces and down. He jumped off, I jumped off. I said, Butch, where are you? I never saw or heard him again. Second Lieutenant Earl D. All, 23 of New Orleans, Louisiana, was killed that day. I tried to move again. Another strafing run by the A1Es, and I jumped up under cover of that and ran again. My mindset at the time was that it was better to get hit by your own than by them. Forward in the Albany clearing perimeter, the situation was improving by the minute. Specialist 4 Dick Ackerman of the recon platoon remembers, our artillery was supporting us so close we would occasionally get some shrapnel. There were planes flying close support. We started digging in whenever we could. My entrenching tool was still attached to my pack left out in the clearing, so I used my bayonet, my fingers, and someone else's tool when it was available. The comfort of a trench just big enough to hold your body is unbelievable. No more than 200 yards away, in that tortured column of desperate Americans, one man prayed for a miracle and the U.S. Air Force delivered it. PFC Shatton Delta Company, who had booby-trapped his own body with a hand grenade, was badly wounded and unable to move. He was directly in the path of a group of North Vietnamese soldiers, methodically sweeping the ground, killing his wounded buddies. Before the North Vietnamese got to me, half a dozen of them, a pilot came over at treetop level, turned straight up, and dropped a canister of napalm dead center on them. I never ceased to be amazed at the accuracy of that drop. The heat of the napalm rolled across my face and body like an open door in a furnace. I owe this pilot more than it is possible for a human to pay. May God bless all pilots. Specialist Bob Tolles, also wounded, was now inside the small perimeter at the head of the column. We learned of impending artillery fire. This helped us take heart. A minute or so later, a violent explosion erupted inside the perimeter. Screams, shouts, and searing white phosphorus flew everywhere. I heard ceasefire being yelled.